We've come to Westwood, California, on the edge of Beverly Hills to visit with one of the most prolific contributors to radio in its golden age, and even today, Mr. Norman Corwin, a triple threat man, if that's the right term to use, writer, producer, director. Norman Corwin, would you consider yourself a triple threat man?
Yes, it's a question of whom I'm threatening, but I have operated on all those three capacities and did so practically from the beginning of my career.
What was the beginning of your career?
I went over to CBS from a job as a public relations man for 20th Century Fox. That's the fancy term for it. Mm. That's the euphemism. The actual term is flack. I was a publicity flack for 20th Century Fox Pictures in New York City. And while there, I listened raptly to the product of a station known then as W2XR, later to be known as WQXR, which is now the New York Times station. And that was one of the first of the many stations that have, I'm happy to say, have sprung up around the country in the years since, which was dedicated to classical music and to programs of a higher IQ.
Mm-hmm.
I gather that you are a representative of one such station, and it seemed to me that they had a very well balanced program, except that it lacked anything to do with the most ancient one of the most ancient of the arts, and that was poetry. So I wrote them a letter proposing that they do something about that, and they said, would you like to come over and audition an idea for us? So one day at the lunch break from my work, I went over and did that, and that resulted in an offer to do a 15-minute weekly program on poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I did that. The pay was all of nothing a week. The price was right from the standpoint of the station. And I was there with a program in New York City. And through a series of serendipities, I was engaged. Somebody at CBS heard me and thought, that I would be an interesting addition to their staff. And they engaged me as a director, not knowing that my chief interest was writing. And so I parlayed those mm-hmm. talents and became my own producer as well. And in very short time, I was able to latch on to some opportunities that found my programs getting attention in the national publications, mm-hmm. Time and other magazines, and there I was on my way.
Well, you had some experience as a sports writer.
Yes.
Way before that.
Yes.
Out in, for the Greenfield Daily Recorder.
That's right. Uh-huh. In Massachusetts. Uh-huh. Right.
Uh-huh. Why did someone who heard you, you were reciting the poetry yourself?
Yes, right. It was more interpreting rather than reciting.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. You were doing that, and they hired you to become a director. Now, is that typical logic? I mean, why?
Good question. A very sound question. There was an omission from what I told you, that I did, on my poetry program, dramatize certain poems. And I engaged not even professional actors, but friends of mine
mm-hmm.
to come up and take roles. And the term I used, which makes me blush now, was I augmented and orchestrated the poetry. In other words, in The Death of the Hired Man, let's say, of Robert Frost, which is dialogue, it was a dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't violate the intentions of the poets, the originals. I the program that was the catalyst was a 15-minute adaptation of Spoon River Anthology.
Mm-hmm.
And I cast with a pretty good ear and eye, I cast five or six people And they were so effective that the program was so effective that CBS said, let's talk to this guy. And of course, I had directed as mm-hmm. well as served as the program's cicerone, so to speak.
You did something for CBS under the title, I believe, Words Without Music.
That's right.
That was right after you moved over there?
That is right.
And you were doing this for the whole network?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was that program? Similar to this?
That was similar to this. Uh-huh. It was an outgrowth. When I went to CBS as a director, I began, for the first few months, I directed the work of other people.
Mm-hmm.
I did some adaptations, a very minor character. But I more or less learned the network console doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And after about 3 or 4 months, I went to the top man in programming. Said, I have an idea for a poetry program, and will you give me $200, which is all it took in those days, mm-hmm. to make you an audition record, which is the equivalent of today's pilot. And he said, sure. And I did. I turned the record over to him. He listened to it. He called me into the office. He said, gee, I like this. How would you like to go on the air and on the network after the Philharmonic concert every Sunday afternoon? I said, great. What do we call the program, he asked. I said, I thought poetic license. He said, poetry, the term poetry will scare people away. He said, what about Words Without Music? Well, I thought it was a banal title, but who are you to argue with the vice president in charge of programming when he's just offered you a silver platter uh-huh. with a half-hour network time? And I was a rookie. Mm-hmm. I was a kid, really. And Then I said, oh, that sounds pretty good. But why without music? He said, well, we don't have the budget for music. So he then said, he thought for a moment and said, how about calling it Norman Corwin's Words Without Music? Well, here in one stroke he had accomplished for me what the highest powered agent in the business could never have accomplished. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine walking into the office of a big network executive and saying, yes, I know this kid is still green and has hay sticking out of his ears, but what about giving him billing ahead of the program on the national network? And the man would have said, that door leads to the corridor, which leads to the elevator. Goodbye, Mr. Smith. Instead of which, he proposed it. And his name was William Lewis, William B. Lewis, and he's a sainted man in my life because he gave me that great opportunity. Great push, and the impetus of the name was the name billing was tremendous.
Now,
and from there mm-hmm. on, it became mm-hmm. the following series was 26 by Corwin, and mm-hmm. then it was Columbia Presents Corwin, and there were two of those. So, and you know, when my books came out, they were called 13 by Corwin, More by Corwin. Mm-hmm. You know, they use, and to this day, I have. A column that runs in Westways magazine out here on the coast, circulation half a million subscribers, mm-hmm. and they call that column Corwin on Media. So the name, that whole thing started with Bill Lewis in that office that day.
You must have had a tremendous amount of confidence in you, and you must have, actually it sounds rather simple as you describe it, but I'm certain that your reputation had been built pretty well by the time this happened.
Not by the time it happened, oddly enough, because the programs that were to get national attention were not yet written. They came out of mm-hmm. Words Without Music. And it wasn't so much that he had confidence in me, and I wasn't singled out at that time. It was that he believed in encouraging creative talent. And that was one way of doing it. And he encouraged others who went various distances under that encouragement. I think I perhaps went pretty far within his lifetime. He's dead. Mm-hmm. He only died a couple of years ago. But I went pretty far. I like to think, I'm vain enough to think that I went pretty far in justifying that faith. But I profited. I was extremely lucky, extremely, because if I had come by 2 years earlier or 2 years later, I might have missed that opportunity. Things change. The tides of of commercial broadcasting are so heavy and so and move so swiftly that that all might have been washed out, has been washed out. No young man can sit in an office now in broadcasting and get that kind of treatment, not a rookie.
Well, there isn't anyone today who would encourage talent that way either.
No, in certain levels there are. I think maybe rock singers and performers of that kind. I mean, where did John Denver come from? Where did any of these kids come from? But that's quite another matter. That's a whole different species. But as far as dramatic writing and directing and producing are concerned, yes, I think you're right. The picture's changed.
What was the reaction then to the people listening to Words Without Music, Norman Corwin's Words Without Music, when it did go on the network then?
Well,
how did the what was the reaction to it? How did you meet that reaction?
In the first place, people, listeners were agog. There had never been anything like it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a program for people who cared about language and ideas and drama. It was not the kind of program that would appeal to Bob Hope's audience.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, my programs will run opposite Bob Hope for a long time. And Bob Hope was the number one rating program on the air, was for years. But CBS felt properly that our audiences were mutually exclusive. And they never even bothered to take a rating of my shows. Later on, some of the big so-called blockbuster shows where I had was on all four networks at once, or when I had some big special commemorative program for CBS, they did take ratings. But never, it was never a question, and here again I was lucky in the timing. There was never a question of the viability of my program based on numbers. That's why I was able to endure. That's why for the entire sweep of radio's golden age, which was the shortest golden age in history, I was free of the harassment that so many writers and directors and producers and networks face today. They are tyrannized by the rating system and by numbers. Wasn't so then.
You worked primarily either for or through CBS.
That is right.
During most of the golden age, right?
Yes, right.
And then you mentioned occasionally a special that you would do would be heard on other networks simultaneously with that of CBS. You were really one of the very few people in radio who develop specials. Today, television,
right.
We have specials every night of the week,
that is
so
right.
They're labeled.
Yes.
But in radio's days, you came up with fantastic things for, it was VE Day and...
Bill of Rights, 150th anniversary of the Declaration ratification of the American Bill of Rights.
Were these considered to be prestige items for the network, and that's why they commissioned you to do that,
yes.
Or had you do all of that sort of thing? They wanted
yes.
some special.
They wanted something special,
mm-hmm.
Right. I don't know whether it began with a lust for prestige. It began with a conscionable attitude toward broadcasting. They felt we ought to have a program on the day, on the night that we, or day or night, when the Germans surrender.
Mm-hmm.
When the Nazis surrender. That was VE Day. So they asked me to suspend a series that I was then working on. It was the second edition of Columbia Presents Corwin, and I was at perhaps number 21 or 22 of the intended 26, and they said, Norman, would you stop, knock off and immediately begin work on a program to be ready on the night of victory in Europe, because we have information from Washington, from the White House, that they expect us to be imminent. So I did. There was no time to be lost, and I prepared on a note of triumph.
And that was such an outstanding program, you had to repeat it within a week, didn't you?
That is right, yes.
And, of course, no recordings were involved or anything, so you just did the whole thing.
Well, the second one was recorded.
Second one was recorded,
yeah.
Not...
Oh, you mean that... No,
I mean, it was not broadcast as a recording.
No,
there
was a network injunction against that.
Mm-hmm.
It was forbidden to use a recording, any kind of recording of the voice. All you could, you couldn't even use recorded music. So all my music had to be live and had to be, and was original. My scores were written, were composed for my shows. None of this canned music stuff.
On a Note of Triumph was an hour-long program.
Yes.
And it must have been a sensational thing to be heard on radio at the time. Was that just CBS or was it the other
network?
Just
CBS.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of response came out of that to prompt the network to repeat it just 5 or 6 days later?
It was the most phenomenal response. I dare say it would be easy to say this if it was some other man's program, but I can tell you very candidly that the kind of impression it made both in the listening audience of the general public and within the radio industry was extraordinary, in that the president of Mutual Broadcasting, a competing network, sent a telegram to Paley saying, when radio distinguishes itself in this fashion, it is good for the entire industry, and we want to congratulate you and thank you. And, you know, that kind of things. CBS itself, the program originated here in California, but at New York, at 45 Madison Avenue, the headquarters of the network, a memorandum went around that day, the following day, saying, those of you who missed that broadcast last night, for those of you, we are declaring an hour, suspending work for an hour at between 3 and 4 this afternoon, and all of the audition rooms will be available to have that program piped into these rooms so that those who missed can hear it, and those who heard it can hear it again. You know, it was given that kind of treatment. It is a little hard in the light of the technological and productional advances that have been made since that time, which, after all, 30 years ago, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. To estimate the degree of novelty and excitement that generated. It was quite new. And the devices which I used and the kind of rhapsodic sweep of the concept were entirely fresh. And emotionally, I think you have to put yourself back in that day also. We were triumphant over one of the two enemies, and yet the war was continuing, and it was rather a peculiar form of celebration. Mm-hmm. And I had to walk a tightrope between not being over-celebrational, because men were still dying, and mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters had men who were still out there at the hazard of their lives fighting for their countries. So it couldn't be a rip-roaring, confetti-strewn celebration, could it? And as I look back on the piece today, and more importantly, as others look back on it, it had a kind of unconsciously prophetic character. It said, in essence, what have we won and what's going to come of it? And is this going to happen again? Mm-hmm. And it examined some of the questions which today are still very much alive. So that last year, on the anniversary of that program, of rather not the program, but of VE Day, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which is the same thing in terms of the calendar, that out here in San, I don't know what happened elsewhere in the country, but out here in California, the San Francisco City Schools had the program piped into their classes twice that day, and it was on the San Francisco Municipal FM station twice that day. And that's 30 years later. I intended that program to serve the needs of one evening, of one hour, and that it is still alive 30 years later is very gratifying, of course. And an LP, the first LP album of it, has mm-hmm. since mm-hmm. been issued. Not interestingly enough, not of the second broadcast, the second of the two, mm-hmm. which is the version that is available on the original 78 RPM album that was issued by Columbia Records.
That was done in the short period after the program, wasn't it? When the LP, the 78s?
That came out right, yes.
Right away?
And that's
a collector's item, by the way,
yes,
to have
is.
That album with the 78s.
Right.
You know?
And that was issued during a time of extreme shortage of materials, mm-hmm. of shellac, as they say in the radio, in the record industry. And so the original album of 13,000, the original edition of 13,000 albums sold out, and they did not reprint because of the shortage. Then, by the time the shellac shortage had ended, so had the war, and so had the acute interest in the program, and so it lay dormant. It lay dormant until this last this current season, when a recording company named Mark 56 Productions out here in California issued an LP, mm-hmm. and that is now available for public sale.
It's great to be able to get this and to hear it again and to listen to the impact of it.
However, it is not the same production. It's the first of the two. And between the first and the second, there were variations. I made changes. Not very extensive changes, mm-hmm. but I did change the certain readings, the emphasis. I wasn't particularly happy with the way that great actor Martin Gable had concluded it. And mm-hmm. I felt he had become a little soft in the coda of the piece, mm-hmm. which is a kind of apotheosis. The student of production would find interesting points of dissimilarity between the two.
It's really wonderful that something that a man creates out of his imagination and his mind and his creativity, all of this together, can last for 30 years, 40 years, or forever, because I think this kind of a thing really will last forever.
I think archivally it may last a good long time, but of course in literature and in music and in painting we're accustomed to things that last much longer than that.
Did you write something similar to that, or a special broadcast for VJ Day at the end of the war?
They called me up, gave me about 6 hours' notice on VJ Day. Now, On Another Triumph took weeks to do,
of course,
and
yeah.
of hard going. It had to be researched, had to be rewritten, and all, and had to be cast and score and everything. They called me and said, "Would you go on the air with something on VJ?" And I had 15 minutes' notice. I did a 15-minute thing. Maybe it ran a little longer, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But in those days, one was very rich in the talent resources, and I had no less than Orson Welles and Olivia de Havilland do that for me.
Oh, well, that was...
That was called 14 August, which is published, uh-huh. and it appears in the last of the three collections called Untitled and Other Dramas. And it's a slight piece, but a thoughtful piece. No fireworks in it.
It was a different approach to the end of the total war then.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm.
Your 26 by Corwin, that followed immediately the Words Without Music on CBS in chronological order?
No, not quite. After Words Without Music, I directed but did not write a series called Pursuit of Happiness, which was a variety show, mm-hmm. That, again, was in my old Words Without Music slot right after the Symphony Orchestra, Philharmonic. And that had... that's where I first had contact with the reigning stars of the day, all of the big Broadway and film mm-hmm. names. And this was... Based on this was written by a number of people who contributed, and I was sort of script supervisor and director, and had that function. In a sense, I produced it, although nominally it was produced by somebody else. And then came
26.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now you had a completely free hand to do as you wanted in that series.
Absolutely.
And you did some fantastic things.
I like to think that most of them were good, ranging from good to fantastic, if I may borrow your term.
You certainly may. Well, some of those things that you did, which, as you look back, stand out as works of most popular acceptance, shall we say?
You asking? Or
yes,
telling
I'm
me?
Asking. Which of these?
Which of these?
Of the 26?
Oh, yeah, well, there would be, to name them, only the radio buff in your audience, I think, would recognize these, and others are invited to look them up. But there would be Untitled, there would be The Odyssey of Runyon Jones, that would be My Client Curly, The Long Name None Could Spell, which in a sense was a precursor of On a Note of Triumph. The Long Name None Could Spell was about Czechoslovakia, and it, in its texture and its thrust and the tilt of its language and its ranging concepts, mm-hmm. and its mobility, it had some of the character. It was a warm-up for On a Note of Triumph. I wasn't conscious of that fact, but mm-hmm. later, mm-hmm. putting them together, you can see, if you stood them side by side, you'd say, this is the overture to On a Note of Triumph. Mm-hmm. And then there were... did I mention Untitled? Yes.
Yes.
Another one called There Will Be Time Later. And there were some fantasies, some comedies. One of them was called Daybreak. And it had to do with the concept, which was then fresh, of a stationary object that travels, apparently stationary, which travels at the same speed as the rotation of the Earth, and it was a point over the Earth which a satellite might have now. And by staying in that point, you'd be in a zone of perpetual dawn, or twilight, or noon, whatever time you chose. Mm-hmm. And this was Daybreak, and it followed, it went around the globe as the Earth turned, and day would drop down to Earth for little vignettes of how the day was received in these various places. And it had kind of, it was a program to be followed on your atlas, and it had a good score, and it had a, it was a very happy combination of circumstances. And that one of the 26, the late great Carl Van Doren selected to use in a book called The Three Readers, an anthology compiled by Carl Van Doren, Clifton Fadiman, and I believe Van Wyck Brooks, each of whom selected his own favorites out of literature of all kinds and ran it together in this anthology. And so I was very honored to find myself in there with Thomas Jefferson and a few others.
How marvelous.
And that was Daybreak. Then there was a program called Double Concerto about two men who, if it were not for the other, each would have been the world's leading interpreter of Brahms. And they had a terrible rivalry. One was a Spaniard and the other was a Hungarian, and it was a funny piece. And
was the plot to overthrow Christmas one of the 26?
No, that was the first program I ever wrote.
That was the first one?
Very first script, original script that I wrote for CBS.
And was that, where was that?
That was on Words Without Music. Mm-hmm. Now, Words Without Music was principally adaptations of others' mm-hmm. writing, and I contributed only two or three original works to that. Mostly I adapted the ranking poets and the, you know, alive and dead. And the plot to overthrow Christmas was an accident, really, because the program fell on Christmas Day, and a man who was attached to the to me from the CBS publicity mm-hmm. department said, what are you going to do on Sunday? I see you have a program on Sunday. Going to do anything about Christmas? And the idea had never entered my head. And I said, yes, it is Christmas, isn't it, on that day? Well, yeah, I guess maybe I will. And he said, well, I have to send out this release. It was 3 or 4 weeks in advance. I have to give it some title. Want to name a title? And off the top of my head, I said, yeah, The Plot to Overthrow Christmas. He said, you're kidding? I said, no, I'll put that down and I'll meet it. Because I went home, and you know, when the time came, and I sat down and I began it simply enough by saying, did you hear about The Plot to Overthrow Christmas? That's the first line. Mm-hmm. Well, Gaddy, now from Maine to the Isthmus of Panama, went on from there. Right. Now, that was the first script I wrote.
You
followed 3 weeks later, a month later, by they fly through the air with the greatest of ease. And that it was they fly that first broke me and broke into the national press. Time magazine had a picture of me and a review of the piece, and you know, that is kind of a mark of arrival, or was then, that you were noticed by a national magazine enough to have a column and a picture and all that.
You did a series, it was a series, wasn't it, called So This Is Radio?
Yeah.
And exactly what was that all
that,
about?
That was an outgrowth of a program that I had written on the 25th anniversary of broadcasting in America called Seems Radio Was Here to Stay. That program, CBS asked its staff generally in a general mimeograph memorandum, did anybody have an idea for a show on that day? And of course, most of them were busy with their programs, and that memorandum went right into the wastebasket. But I was young and eager and a freshman, and I thought, let's see what we can do with that. And I wrote a program called Seems Radio's Here to Stay, and it had a lot of notice in the industry, and CBS was so proud of it that they issued a private edition, a publication, very handsomely done. I will show it to you when we put the microphone down.
Okay.
Commemorating that, and they sent it out to 2,000 public figures and broadcasting bigwigs as a kind of in-house thing. Now, because of the success of that, they felt emboldened to do a series called So This Is Radio. I have blocked that from memory. I was not happy with that series. Mm-hmm. I think that it was too much of the same thing. And I won't burden you or your listeners with the details of my disenchantment with it, but I didn't.
Were you getting just one question about it then? Mm-hmm. Did you get direction from the network on that?
No. The network was heaven in those days. Mm-hmm. I was given absolute freedom. I was an entity, and nobody bothered me. They were cordial and helpful and cooperative and supportive. And one could not have asked for finer auspices under the Medicis, the Medicis.
It's marvelous to hear that. It's wonderful to hear that. I doubt that there's anyone in network broadcasting today that has that kind of freedom. People have the freedom to create whatever they want, but whether or not it gets on the air is another thing today.
Well, the whole picture has changed. Yeah. The emphasis now is numbers, is audience. Now and then they do find things on radio and television. Not radio so much. They really killed that dear old girl. But in television, they come to life on some special occasion.
You're going to try to pump a little life into radio again, I understand, with Ray Bradbury. Isn't there a project underway now?
Yeah, it is indeed. I have I directed two pilots. The object was for them to be done by National Public Radio. Are you on NPR?
I have a program on NPR. Not this station, but we do one. Yes.
And at the moment, it is under study for the logistics of budget and all that. Mm-hmm. May go that way, or it may go into syndication, or may even be taken commercially. Mm-hmm. All three, there is interest in all three areas at the moment. This could bring back something of the old flavor. It'll never come back fully until such time as the entrepreneurs and the management of broadcasting say, we want to do it, and we are going to take the money, and we are going to commission a composer. Now, one of the two Bradbury pilots represents the closest to an original score on a serious dramatic program since the days when I was doing Columbia Prisons Corwin. And the feeling is great at the effectiveness of this is to be measured against any program that goes on canned music. However, this one uses a good deal of synthesized and electronic effects in the music, and coming together with Bradbury's brand of poetic science mm-hmm. fiction that works, I think.
It would be a joy to watch you at work directing one of these plays, or to have seen you do this. I had a chance to, a lot of people did, on the public television, did a radio version, if you will, of the plot to overthrow Christmas.
Yes.
And it was marvelous not only to see a group of pros, I mean, the actors you had were really pros, and every once in a while the camera kind of came back, and we got a chance to see Norman Corwin at work. And directing those actors, watching you direct those actors was like watching Toscanini direct the symphony. It was it was lyrical, and it was just a marvelous experience to see you do that. It was great that you provided us with that opportunity to see you at work in that respect.
That program was a great deal of fun and continues to be fun. That, as I say, it was the first I wrote, and it's had a good long run, and it's still fun.
It'll be shown on public television every year at Christmas. They're always looking to write something with Christmas in it, I guess, and they've got a winner for the rest of the
year. I don't know of any other program that has quite the same stance about Christmas as that, in that it's kidding and yet sentimental.
Mm-hmm. That and all of the things that you've done provided radio listeners over the years with a tremendous amount of quality on the air. And for that, I want to thank you. It's rare that we can have a chance to thank the man who did all of that. We do thank you.
And I thank you. It's very nice to hear.
We appreciate your spending some time with us today, too, Norman Corwin.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you.